Thanks, everybody, for coming out this evening. As always, it's a real treat and a privilege to have Judy Jantz with us. And it's great to see the Walker family return. So please help me give her a nice warm welcome.
Thank you. My brother Gary and my sister-in-law Kathy are here tonight. There were seven kids in our family. I was the third one of the first batch. The first batch was born in South Dakota. The second batch was born in Bisbee, Arizona. And Gary is the third one of the second batch. our mother always specified batches. And I just found out I'm going to be going to Nashville in October, and Arlen, the first one of the second batch, is going to come to Nashville to see me there. In 1967, when I was going to get married, I went to a bridal shop that used to be on, I'm not in Tucson. It was on Country Club just east of Broadway. And I bought a wedding dress, most expensive dress I ever bought, $99. So I used the wedding dress, and that wedding was good for 13 years. my brother Arlen was getting married, and his bride needed a wedding dress. And so she wore my wedding dress, and they got more than 50 years out of it, didn't they? Because busk kids are tall, and they tend to look for tall spouses. And so then, a number of years later, my brother Gary was getting married, and Kathy needed a wedding dress. So that wedding dress has been good for 113 years. So if you amortize that $100, it's less than a dollar a year. 48 years. Oh, 48 years. You know, that's close enough for government work, don't you think? So that's the wedding dress story. And today, anybody here remember Skippy Peanut Butter? And the Skippy Peanut Butter radio commercials, "Look for me in my bright green dress." Ah, well, here's my bright green blouse. When I was in college, in 1964, I tried to sign up for the creative writing course. And the professor said, "You're a girl." And I said, "So?" He said, "Girls become teachers or nurses, boys become writers," and he didn't let me into his class. So I married a guy who was allowed in the writing class. He never published anything, but that's another story. But I got a teaching degree. I taught high school English at Pueblo High School for 2 years. And 2 years was about all I was good for. So the summer after my second year of teaching English, I signed up at the University of Arizona to take library science courses. And I took two courses that summer, selection of materials and cataloging, and they were both really tough courses. But when school came around that year, I had signed a contract to teach at Pueblo again the following year. In the meantime, my husband got a job out on the reservation. And the week before school started, the librarian at the school on the reservation quit. And so I was offered the job. They said if I would continue to take library science courses, they would get me a provisional certificate. And so with 6 units of library science under my belt, I started being a librarian. I knew how to do cataloging, by God. So that first semester at night school, I took a course I really hated. It was a night course on junior college, and I wasn't really interested in that. The second semester of that year, I took a children's literature class from Helen Renthal. And what I learned in that class was librarians are supposed to tell stories, not read stories, but tell stories. And boy, was that something I wanted to learn. And so once I had that class under my belt, for the next 4.5 years, while I was on the reservation, I told 26 stories a week in K through 6 classrooms. And Thursdays were storytelling days. We lived at Three Points, so it was a 30-minute drive from our house on the hill to Sells, where the school was. And on Thursday mornings, I would memorize the story I was going to tell that week. Well, the kids on the reservation were short and very brown. I was very tall. They knew that when I came to the classroom to talk to them, it would be just for fun. I found out years later when one of the kids I interested in reading while I was a librarian started reading my murder mysteries and wrote to me and told me that the kids back then referred to me, because I always wore a green dress on those days, they referred to me as the Jolly Green Giant. So a couple of weeks ago, I was walking through the mall in Bellevue on my way to lunch, and at the very back of a store, I saw this flash of green. It's sort of like the color of cottonwood trees when they first come out in the spring. I went to lunch, but as soon as lunch was over, I bought this, and now the Jolly Green Giant is on the road again. Because that class was really important to me. Because I've been telling stories one way or another ever since. I love being on tour. I love having a chance to speak to real live people. Somehow, you don't get the same feedback when you're sitting in front of your computer screen in your dining room, talking to your face. And no, that's not for me. I would rather see people's faces and hear people's laughter as opposed to sitting there in silence. The other thing about those Zoom calls, I have two little obnoxious dachshunds. And as soon as they hear a stranger's voice in the house, they are sure we are being invaded. And since they're dachshunds, telling them to be quiet is not ever going to work. And so I tell my host, okay, if the dogs start barking, we just have to wait them out, because eventually they'll stop. But I'm really happy to be on the road again. I'm not happy to be on the road without my husband, but Bill has developed some health issues that make it really impossible for him to travel anymore. So I'm here solo, but our daughter is looking after him back home, and he's in good hands. We went for 2 years without him being on the proper medication, which meant that his health was really impaired and he could barely talk. And now that he is on the right meds, we actually were able to have a fight a couple of weeks ago, and it was wonderful. This week I received an email from, I'm supposed to be talking about the book, right? I suppose I should try to focus and talk about the book instead of just blabbing away.
That's a brother.
Do not make me mad. Actually, the neurologist that told Bill he didn't have Parkinson's 2 years ago, when he clearly does have Parkinson's, and we lived with untreated Parkinson's for 2 years, I think there's a neurologist that's going to come up dead in one of my books very, very soon. Blessing of the Lost Girls is my 66th published novel. I launched off on my first Beaumont book in the middle of March of 1983. So for 40 years, I've been writing books at a rate of 1.6 a year, year in and year out, for 40 years. Actually, I've now written, this is number 66, by the way, number 67, Den of Iniquity is the next Beaumont book. It is written and in New York. So usually it takes me about 6 months to write a book. That came to a screeching halt when I was working on the most recent Allie Reynolds book, Collateral Damage. That book took me a whole damn year to write. I struggled with that book. Bill is actually a retired electronics engineer. He's a double E. He has now become a working LE. He's my literary engineer. And engineers fix stuff that is broken. So I was trying to write Collateral Damage, and it was moving at a glacial pace. So finally, after I had written about a third of the book, I gave it to Bill, and I asked him if he would read it. He had it for rather longer than I expected. And finally, he handed it back, and he said, "This is a mess. I can't read it." So not only is he honest, he's also very brave. But I read what I had given him, and he was right. It was a mess. Do you remember that old song, "The wise man built his house upon a rock"? Well, that book was built on sand. What I needed to do was introduce the bad guy, which I had not done in the first third of the book. And then I needed to timestamp each chapter so both the reader and the writer knew what day it was, what the location was, so what characters were going to be involved in that chapter. And by doing that, I was able to finish the book. And when I sent it to my editor, she loved it. And you didn't think it was that bad, right? So, but here's the thing. Our mother cooked 3 meals a day for 9 people. She had several rules when it came to mealtime. You eat a little bit of everything. For me, that included parsnips. I shudder at the very idea of parsnips. And for our brother Jim, who was the second one of the second batch, it was green peas. He could turn green at the very sight of a green pea. And he was often in the middle of the bench on the back side of the table. That was also critical for green peas and Jim. So you had to eat a little bit of everything and everything on your plate or no dessert. So that teaching of my mother has come with me into my literary life in the following fashion. I am not allowed to think about the next book until I clear my plate of the one I'm currently working on. So while I was working on Collateral Damage, probably in June of 2021, I received a phone call from a friend in Oregon. She's a friend. Now, she started out as a fan. She's become a friend over the years. She volunteered in hospitals for a long time. She's now a retired fire and police chaplain. But for 7 years, she looked after her husband, Randy, who was dying of Agent Orange brain cancer. So one day while Randy was in one of the VA hospitals, she went wandering looking for a book. And on the Free to Good Home bookshelf there in the VA hospital, she found Until Proven Guilty. And she read it and became an instant fan. Her first husband was Sue. So her two kids, Aaron and Yvette, are half Anglo, half Indigenous. So when the Walker books came out, she loved the Walker books, still does. In the 90s, in real life, there was a killer who roamed the West known as the Boxcar Killer. He traveled around in boxcars, and he did hate crimes before hate crimes were a thing. And what he liked to do was push Native Americans under moving trains. So a Rosebud Sioux named James was working in a railroad yard in a small city in central Oregon when he had his encounter with the boxcar killer. He was pushed under the train. He was dragged for a mile and a half before the engineer was able to stop the train. Law enforcement came. They pronounced him dead, zipped him into a body bag, and sent him to the morgue, which was in the basement of the local hospital. As I said, it was a small community, and there was a nurse in the hospital who was also Sue, who knew James. And so when her shift was over that night, she went down to the morgue to wash his hair, which is a long-standing Sioux custom. When she unzipped the body bag, his arm came out because he wasn't dead. He went from the morgue to the OR for the first of the countless operations that it took to duct tape him back together. He ended up as a paraplegic. He lost the use of his right hand. He had to learn to speak again. He had to learn to read again. And Loretta, as a volunteer at those hospitals, before he was able to read on his own, she would go to his hospital room and read books to him. And because she read my books, she loved my books, she read them. And because she loved the Walker books, she read them to him, and he loved them. He recovered enough that he was able to live more or less independently, and he spent the next 20 years of his life working with disaffected urban Indian youth in the Portland area, trying to get them back on the right path. He called Loretta sometime in the spring of 2021, shortly before his death. And he said to her, "Tell your friend to write more Walker books. There aren't enough Indian heroes." Boy, did I, and by the way, when he died, he did not go home to the reservation in a casket. He went home wrapped in a buffalo robe. So boy, did I want to write that book. But Evie Best's daughter had not yet cleaned her plate of collateral damage. So finally I did. It was in New York, it was being edited, and I could start thinking about the next Walker book. Well, I knew it would be a Walker book. I knew it would have something to do with murdered Indigenous girls, but I couldn't come up with a title. The Bakker books have very distinct titles: Hour of the Hunter, Kiss of the Bees, Day of the Dead, Dance of the Bones. But they also have a little bit of a twist to them, because you don't think of bees kissing and you don't think of bones dancing. So I spent 3 nights lying awake, tossing and turning, trying to come up with a title. Finally, in despair, I went to talk to my literary engineer. And I said, I need a title for this book. It's going to be about missing Indigenous and murdered Indigenous girls. It's going to be a Walker. The title has to have a twist to it. He thought about it for maybe a minute and a half. And he said, what about Blessing of the Lost Girls? Well, he told me that on a Monday night. I started writing the book on Tuesday morning, and I finished this book in 2 months flat, beginning to end. This story just flowed in a way I can't explain it. It was really magical. When I'm writing a Walker book, on the reservation, some of the stories I told were the stories and legends of the Tohono O'odham people. You'll notice I'm not telling you any of those tonight, and there's a very real reason for that. It's September. The Tohono O'odham's stories are winter telling tales. They can only be told between the middle of November and the middle of March. And once I learned that was the rule, I have abided by that rule. But I wanted to make reservation life accessible to people who would never come to Arizona, much less go visit a reservation. And so I deliberately wove those stories into the background of my books. When I'm working on a Walker book, I have my laptop, of course. I have my coffee, of course. But I also have my Tohono O'odham English dictionary, English Tohono O'odham dictionary, which it's coffee stained and tattered, and but it's one well-used dictionary, believe me. In this book, I was putting in, I put in the stories of the four quarrelsome brothers. And those are that's the origin of the four seasons. So I was working along happy as a clam. I got spring, I got summer. And it was time to do fall. And I opened my dictionary and there was no word for fall. So I looked for autumn. There was no word for autumn. I actually called to the reservation and asked, and nobody knew. Well, I had received an email from a young woman named White Fawn, and her father is a Pima, and he had asked her to write to me because he loved my stories and wanted to know how I knew all those words. And I told them it came from the dictionary. So I wrote back to White Fawn, and I said, I need to know the word for fall. Please ask your father. And she wrote back and said, there isn't one. There isn't one. So I managed to figure out a workaround on that for the book. But I really appreciated the fact that this Pima elder that I had never met was willing to help me on this book. And I asked her if he would mind if I dedicated the book to him. And she asked him, and he said, oh, no, please don't do that. Okay, I won't. So then when the tour was published, I sent her a note, and I said, I hope your father will be able to come to one of the events. And so I heard from her, and she said that he's coming to the one in Mesa. I think that's tomorrow. I hope it's tomorrow. It may not be tomorrow. My media escort, actually, the media escort who is here, Nancy Stuby, is also in Blessing of the Lost Girls as a character. Because when Dan Pardee, the main character in this book, comes to Phoenix and needs to do a whirlwind tour of the local news stations, he needs a media escort. And Nancy was right there, and I asked her if she would be willing to be in the book, and she is. She told me, yes, I'm happy to be in the book as long as I wear my apricot pantsuit. And so she said, I can't wear it anymore, but I really love it. And so I said, okay. So I put her in the apricot pantsuit. The problem is, when Dan Pardee arrives at the airport, he's colorblind. So anyway, I heard from White Fawn this morning, and she said her father is going to come to the one on Wednesday. And I said, well, would he mind if I introduced him? And she said, oh, no, please don't do that. Please don't do that. I'm pretty sure I'll be able to recognize a Pima in the crowd of Anglo people. But she said, I have to work tomorrow, so he will be coming with my sister, Autumn. Don't you just love it? So, I could not have made that up. So, Blessing of the Lost Girls. I wasn't going to make the same mistake I made with Collateral Damage. And so I started by introducing you. The book starts meeting Charlie, this guy who he's at the RV park. He's sort of a mysterious guy. He's obviously a bachelor, but he's not really interested in women, and they don't know if he's gay. They can't, you know, everybody's trying to figure out what makes Charlie tick. And so everybody is interested in him, but nobody has any kind of a problem with him, except for one entity in that RV park. And that's the obnoxious little dog that lives next door. And that's a very important part of this story, by the way. I made up my mind very early on in my writing career that I didn't want my characters to stay stuck in time. So they've gotten older. Beaumont, I gave Beaumont my birthday so I would remember how old he is. Which was fine until during the pandemic. I stopped counting for a couple of years. And then it got kind of confusing when I thought I was one age, but I was actually 2 years older than that. But when we met Diana Ladd in Hour of the Hunter, she was a young widow with a young child working on the reservation. Now she is a much older widow, and she's decided to call it quits. And her daughter, Lonnie, is struggling with what can she do to help her mother? How is she going to take care of her mother? Because between her brother's suicide and her father's death, her mother has just lost all sense of wanting to be on this planet. I forgot to tell you one more thing. I told you about James. Well, when you read this book and when you encounter a character named John Wheeler, you'll know that James said there aren't enough Indian heroes, but now he is one. So this book features prominently Brandon Walker's son-in-law, Dan Pardee. And the problem with Dan is he's sort of like a man without a country. He was, he's half Apache. His mother was from the San Carlos. She was a beautiful young woman who took off for Hollywood thinking she was going to be a star. She ended up marrying a stuntman who was a jerk and who murdered her when Dan Pardee was only 4 years old. Dan's grandparents came and took him, brought him back to Arizona and raised him. And in this book, he has a realization. He was well cared for by his grandparents, but he never felt as though his grandmother really loved him. He always felt as though what she was doing for him was out of a sense of duty or obligation rather than anything else. And in the course of this book, he realizes that every time his grandmother looked at him, she saw the face of the man who murdered her daughter. And it's interesting to me that my characters uncover those little pieces, and I don't see them coming until all of a sudden they get there. And that's part of the magic of writing. So Dan Pardee dresses like a cowboy. He looks like an Indian in every aspect except for his bright green eyes. And so he's neither here nor there. He has spent years living on the Tohono O'odham. Well, among the desert people, the word O'ob has two meanings. One is enemy, and the other meaning is Apache. So he's not exactly at home on the reservation. They call him Nauach Apache, which means friendly Apache. But Nauach O'ob, which means friendly Apache. But on the other hand, so he still feels like an outsider. But on the other hand, driving through the countryside, he knows the Tohono O'odham names for all the birds and plants and animals. And he realizes he doesn't know the Apache names for all those things. And so he has this sense of not belonging. And I think that's a reflection of me as a very tall, smart girl in Bisbee, Arizona, who wore glasses. I was very much an outsider, and that has served me in good stead because it's turned me into an observer rather than a participant. But that's part of his character that I really relate to. Charlie is someone who really likes rodeos. And the people in the RV park think that's interesting because he doesn't apparently have any kids, but he follows rodeos. And this book starts on the weekend of the Tucson Rodeo. What he really likes about rodeos is barrel racers, young female barrel racers. And what he likes to do with young female barrel racers is murder them. And Indian ones are always a good bet because nobody really cares about investigating those, as we all know. At least we finally figured that out. I knew it very early on, and Hour of the Hunter, the first Walker family books, dealt with a young Tohono O'odham woman being murdered. And her killer was actually caught by Brandon Walker, but the justice system gave him a slap on the wrist and he is out and looking for the people who took put him away in Hour of the Hunter. So human remains are found near Bowie. Now, I haven't listened to the Audible book. The letters B-O-W-I-E in Arizona refer to the town, and it is pronounced Bowie. In the rest of the country, those letters, B-O-W-I-E, are pronounced Bowie. And the remains happen to be found between Bowie and San Simon. And I left very clear directions that the audio people need to write San Simon, not Saint Simon. I'll find out within a matter of days if the audio people got it right, because believe me, people will write and let me know if those names were mispronounced. But if they are mispronounced, it's not for lack of trying. Well, the interesting thing about San Simon and Bowie is that they're in Cochise County. And so Dan Pardee has to go to Cochise County investigating as a member of the Murdered Indigenous Task Force. I know there's a real one now, but I use my literary license and I created one of my own. And it works. So he goes and he's worried about meeting up with Sheriff Joanna Brady. And when she learns he's a Fed, she expects somebody wearing a suit. She does not expect somebody wearing boots and jeans and a Stetson. And he said, when they meet, he said, I didn't expect, you're not what I expected. She said, you didn't expect a woman? He said, I didn't expect you to be so short. When you meet Jennifer Brady for the first time, it's on the first page of the first Joanna Brady book, Desert Heat, and she's 9 years old. She's just had a tiny smidgen of sex ed at Greenway School in Bisbee, Arizona. And this scene takes place on the evening of her parents' 10th wedding anniversary. So she has had something about sex ed in class, and she has counted up on her fingers, and she realized there aren't enough months between her parents' anniversary and her birthday. And so she asks her mother in front of her grandmother, was I a preemie? Which, of course, she was not. The baby was on time. The wedding was late. And what's interesting to me all these years later is how that scene set the stage for all the interactions between Joanna Brady and her mother, Eleanor, throughout the books. I did not plan that. And yet, there it is, right there on that first page of the first book. How do I do that? I have no idea. So now, Jenny is no longer 9 years old. Now she is a senior at Northern Arizona University with a major in criminal justice. And when it becomes apparent that the remains belong to a barrel racer, someone she actually competed against, and you saw her compete against that character's name has gone out of my head. It's okay. I can forgive myself for not being able to remember that character's name right now. But Jenny actually competed against the deceased racer. Rosa. Thank you. Rosa. Thank you. Somebody knows. You get a gold star. Jenny becomes involved in this investigation. And so it's fun to see Jenny really coming into her own as a character. So it's a Brady Walker crossover, but it has far more to do with Jennifer Brady than it does with her mother, Joanna. How much of this book have you already read?
The first three chapters.
Okay. So now I'd like to tell you about something that isn't going to happen this week. I read all my own email. I reply to them. And this week, I heard from a woman who is the program director at a dementia care facility in Tucson. And she said she has one patient named Nancy, who still has very high cognition, but she is mad at the world. And the only thing that makes her happy is to have one of my books in hand. And so, boy, I bit on that one. So I offered to come on this week and have lunch with Nancy and then do a program for the residents. And I did that for a specific reason. Growing up in Bisbee, our mother was a stay-at-home mother, and she taught us. She did all the cooking. We did all the dishwashing. She washed on Monday. She ironed on Tuesday. And her head was full of hundreds of songs. And she taught them to us. And we sang. We sang while we were doing the dishes. We sang while we were cleaning house on Saturday mornings. We sang while we were riding around in the car. And the last time we were all together before our brother Jim passed away was for my folks' 65th wedding anniversary. And we sat in this small conference room in a motel in Bisbee, singing all the songs she taught us. And when we left, my husband turned to me and said, "How did you all learn to sing in harmony?" And I looked at him and I said, "Doesn't everybody?" Well, it turns out our mother taught us how to sing in harmony. And so my plan was to go to the dementia facility. When my first husband, the one who died at age 42 of chronic alcoholism, my second husband says the first one was so bad that it's made his life perfect. When he was dying in the hospital here in Scottsdale, he had been hospitalized with no kidney or liver function for more than a month before he finally passed away. And the last night I was with him and we had been divorced for a year and a half by then. But that last night, why don't I just tell you the poem? We keep a vigil by his midnight bed, his mother and his former wife, grieving for the man we loved and lost. It's harder for his mother than for me. I've already known the sting of loss. She's only now begun to see she cannot win. A nurse comes in to loosen his restraints. She looks at the women waiting there. She knows she doesn't want to say. The hours creep by. All stories are expended. We need some sound to hold the night at bay. please sing, his mother asks me, and I do. It is a serenade of love, of songs we knew and treasured through the years, from bawdy barroom ditties to sweet hymns. The hours flow by. I hold his hand. I sing a line and wait to see if he will breathe again. He doesn't. It's over. Amen. I'm sure he heard those songs. I know he heard those songs. And so my plan was to go to the dementia care facility this week and sing those songs in memory of my mother, because once she lost my father, it was as though our mother had a personality transplant, and she became mean and angry and spiteful. I was really hurt by it at the time, and now I understand it was probably a form of undiagnosed dementia, and that's why I wanted to go. I found out this morning that there is a COVID outbreak in that facility, so I will not be able to go. But I've been trying to remember some of those songs, and now you're going to be stuck hearing them. Oh, they cut down the old pine tree, and they hauled it away to the mill to make a coffin of pine for that sweetheart of mine. They cut down the old pine tree, but she's not alone in her grave tonight. 'Tis there my heart will ever be. Though we drifted apart, still they cut down my heart. When they cut down the old pine tree. Our mother loved sad songs. She really loved sad songs. But she also loved fun songs. I know a little ditty, it's as crazy as can be. The guy who wrote it didn't want it, so he handed it to me. He said he didn't want it because he thought it blew. And that's the very reason that I'm handing it to you. It's the song the alligator sang while coming through the rye to serenade the elephants up in the crowd so high. It's the song the iceman shouted as he shoveled in the coal and was echoed by the monkeys up around the northern pole. Oh, ain't we crazy, ain't we crazy? But this is the way we pass the time away. Oh, ain't we crazy, ain't we crazy? We're gonna sing this song all night today. There once was a farmer who took a young miss. There once was a farmer who took a young... No, I've got Viva La Cookery made. Who took a young miss in back of the barn where he gave her a lecture on horses and cattle and chickens and eggs and told her that she had such beautiful manners that suited a girl of her charms, a girl that he wanted to take in his washing and ironing, and then if she did, they could get married and raise lots of sweet violets, sweeter than the roses, covered all over from head to toe, covered all over with sweet violets. There once was a maiden to cooking school went. Viva la cookery maid, on dishes delicious her heart was intent. Viva la cookery maid, her apron was spotless, her cap it was neat. The figure she made was distractingly sweet, but the stuff she concocted a goat couldn't eat. Viva la cookery maid, she started with donuts that didn't cook through. Viva la cookery maid, she toyed with the soup and she used it for glue. Viva la cookery maid, her griddle cakes might have been used for a doormat. With her biscuits, her brother disabled three cats. Viva la cookery maid. At last she made something, a pie, so she said. Viva la cookery maid. 'Twas hard as sole leather and heavy as lead. Viva la cookery maid. She put it away and retired to bed. A burglar broke in and upon it he fed. when he came in the morning, that burglar was dead. Vive la cookery. Of course I loved that one. It was a murder mystery. Anyway, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be on the road. If anyone has any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. We didn't really have a Q&A beforehand. So do you have any questions? Yes.
That so-called professor who said that women cannot be writers. Have you sent him any of your books?
Actually, the professor said I couldn't be a writer. And my first husband said there was only going to be one writer in our family, and he was it. They were both deceased before my first book was published. But I expect that every time I make the New York Times bestseller list, both of them are spinning in their respective graves. However, in Hour of the Hunter, the first Walker book, the main character, Diana Ladd, is a teacher on the reservation who wants to be a writer. Her husband was allowed in a creative writing class that was closed to her. He's dead at the beginning of the book. And the crazed killer turns out to be a former professor of creative writing from the University of Arizona. So I made it work.
Which one was convicted of sex crimes and sent to prison in Florence?
Yes. Yes. This is my book of poetry, After the Fire. It is the story, it's the story of my journey in that first marriage. I started writing these shortly after we were first married. There was only going to be one writer in our family. So we lived 30 miles from town, 2 miles off the highway, 7 miles to the nearest neighbor and or telephone. So when he was passed out cold in his chair at night, I would sit at the dining room table and jot off these little pieces of poetry. I thought I was being true to my art. I never showed them to him. I put them in the strong box, a place I never knew. I knew he would never look. And I didn't look at them again either. I wrote these over a period of probably 20 years. And when I finally got them out again was in 1983, after his death, when I had to go to the strong box to get out the documents you must present when someone dies, the marriage certificates, the birth certificates, all of that stuff. And I was shocked when I read through them, because it was like seeing my life in instant replay. And I showed them to someone else, and they said, these need to be a book. And so they are a book. There are little essays that accompany each poem that say what was going on. Here's one I wrote probably in 1969. It is a slow dawning, this realization of existence on the leash, of making excuses for thoughts and actions that were never really executed. It is a slow awakening, this knowledge that your life is a compromise of other people's intentions, of what shall happen, what shall be done with your flesh and bones. Yes, and mine too, although nobody ever intimated that you might be possessed of one of those, for intellect has always been a masculine domain. But with the dawning, the realization that you, a newborn Eve, have tried the bitter fruit of knowledge, can you then go back to live the plastic lie you were before? No. So this is here. When you're involved in an addictive relationship, it's difficult to imagine that anyone else could possibly be that dumb and fall for all the lies and be that, you know. And so when this book lands in the hands of someone who's in that situation, of someone who thinks they're the only one it's ever happened to. It can be a real life boy. And so if you know of somebody who needs to have this book in their hands, think about giving it, because I promise you it will be a welcome gift. Okay, that was the lady from the front row, who is not my cousin, said that it's a really healing book, and I think it is. Yes. Yes. The thing that happens to you when you're in that kind of a situation is you actually go nuts. And so I by the early 80s, we were living here in Phoenix, and I came home from church, and he had covered the doorknobs with olive oil to drive the evil spirits out of the house. And then he went to bed and took a nap. The bottle shattered as it hit the wall. I stood with arm upraised and knew that I had smashed it. It could as easily have been his head. The anger raged around me like a roaring flood, flooding me with murderous intent. I flushed the bottles from their hidden layers and broke them one by one. I took him to the doctor then, not because he needed it. I did. I actually checked him into a psychiatric hospital that night because I was totally nuts. And it was dangerous for him to be in the house. But I think what's interesting about after the fire is to see how early on in the relationship, the creative part of me understood what I was up against, while the conscious part of me was still deep in denial. So if I know I talk about after the fire every time, and I'm sure some of you think, oh my God, not that one again. She's still talking about that book. Yes, I am, because I know that in every audience, there's at least one person who needs to have that book in their hands. Any other questions or comments, or should I just shut up and go away? Pardon?
Never to stop at the rest stop at Dr. Week. Too far from to stop, especially when I was traveling alone. I never will.
You, I have to tell you that you are the second person in 2 days who have told me they will never stop at the rest area at Picacho Peak.
I was driving by and I get chills. Just keep going, man. Keep going.
I don't really need to pee. You know, there's no way when I'm sitting with my laptop on my lap, erasing my fingerprints, I can no longer use my fingerprints as ID to clear security on my clear card, because my fingerprints no longer register. But it doesn't occur to me how my books are going to affect people on the other side of my computer screen, and they do. I'm sorry about that. Kitt Peak is really beautiful.
It was one of those. I went to Tucson once a month with work, and I traveled by myself. You know, state business, okay, back to Tucson, and then on the way back, it was always evening. And it was like, there's no way in hell I'm stopping. Getting home.
Well, it's good to have a sidekick.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming tonight. I hope you enjoy reading Blessing of the Lost Girls as much as I enjoyed writing it. So thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.